People are hungry basically because they're very poor, and so hunger is as complex as poverty is. It's, you know, the causes of poverty or the causes of hunger, and so many of the factors behind hunger and poverty interrelate with one another. In a way, I think of what we're getting into here as being simply an extension of what we had earlier this evening, Dave and his presentation on Namibia, and Joel with the Vespers, which certainly set the stage. Here we are talking about a feast of life, and yet we're facing the fact that hundreds of millions of our brothers and sisters around the world are so extremely poor that they aren't able to assemble even an adequate, minimally nutritious diet from day to day. Now, the statistics vary. You get a lot of different estimates, but by any of the estimates, the numbers are huge. And that can immobilize us. We need certainly to keep our focus on the fact that the numbers represent precious human lives. People whose lives are no less precious to God than your life and mine, or than our children's lives. Well, there are a lot of things to be said about hunger that I'm not going to attempt to say tonight. I would like to have us focus on just a couple of things, and in that connection I'll say a bit about Bread for the World. The first thing is that hunger, whatever else it is preeminently a public policy issue. Do everything else you can think of to in response to hunger, and there are a lot of things we can do, and neglect public policy, and you've got a formula for failure. Let me illustrate that briefly. I would guess that most of us are Lutherans. I don't know what the percentages are here at Holden Village, but in any case, I am. A couple of years ago, I had to speak at a district convention in Minnesota, and so I picked up the phone and I called the key hunger persons of the three major Lutheran bodies and asked how much they had gotten through the churches by way of hunger contributions, hunger appeals, the previous year. It came out about as I expected, a little more by average, on average, than a dollar per person a year. Now, there are 9 million Lutherans, roughly, in the States, and we probably contribute somewhere around $12 to $14 million a year now, I would guess, in response to those hunger appeals. So that's, you know, somewhere around $1.25, $1.50 per person a year. 9 million of us. And I can tell you, because I've seen something of what that work does abroad, that those dollars were very well invested. And they did an enormous amount for lots and lots of people. And they should have been much more than what they were. But now, by comparison, you have to remember that very often one stroke of the president's pen or one vote in Congress can have an impact just in dollar amounts of a hundredfold what we Lutherans do in the course of a year in our contributions to alleviate hunger. In church, we give to help hungry people, but by our silence on public policy, we very often lock people more deeply into hunger. And that's a contradiction, a situation that should not and need not exist. Well, that's just one example. There are many, many issues that are hunger-related issues that directly touch the lives of people and determine whether or not they are going to be able to eat or die. Trade is a hunger issue. Employment is a hunger issue. The whole question of military spending is a hunger issue, and many others. So hunger is, above all, preeminently a public policy issue. And if we're going to effectively address hunger, we've got to address it also from the standpoint of national policies that make a difference. Now let me make one other basic point, and that is that what we do or fail to do makes a difference. And I'd like to illustrate that too. My favorite story on this is about Barbara Ward. Some of you probably have read some of Barbara Ward's stuff. She was a internationally respected development economist, and a British citizen, devout Catholic. Barbara Ward, back in the late 60s, attended a SOTAPOX consultation. SOTAPOX stands for Society, Development, and Peace, and is a commission that works under the joint auspices of the Vatican and the World Council of Churches. And I think in the late 60s was when it really first got off the ground. I may be mistaken there, but anyway, they had a gathering of some top church leaders from around the world and some top development specialists such as Barbara Ward to deal with the whole question, what is the church's responsibility in a world of hunger and poverty? And as so often happens at church gatherings, all the right resolutions were adopted. And Barbara Ward, perhaps being newer to church gatherings than some of us are, figured that really meant business. And so afterwards, she came to this country, was talking to a handful of members of Congress at a reception they had for her. And with all the enthusiasm that Barbara Ward could muster, and she was nothing if not enthusiastic, she told them that the churches in the United States were about to build broad public support for a big new effort globally against hunger and poverty. There was dead silence in the room. Until at last, Walter Mondale, who was then a young senator from Minnesota, spoke up and said, "Barbara, I'll give you a phone call when I get the first letter." And about 10 years or so ago, just about the, well, not quite that long ago, when about the time Bread for the World was just starting up, I heard Mondale tell that story, and he added, "I haven't had to make that call yet." Why? You know, where are the Christians? Where are the people who care? I'm convinced there are a lot of people who care, and you'll find many of them in our churches each Sunday. Sure, I know there's a lot of apathy there, a lot of indifference, and a lot of ignorance about what's going on in the world, but there's also a lot of compassion, people who really care when other people hurt, and if they know specifically what they can do to make a difference, many of them are willing to do it. But we have not learned very well yet how to register our concern to the nation's decision makers in a way that they can understand and in a way that will help them translate that concern into public policy. Well, basically, that's the reason why Bread for the World got started. About 9 years ago, when we began to organize nationally, our vision was to enable Christians from across the country, Christians of every denomination, of every theological background, perspective, invite them to come together on the basis of our common faith in Jesus Christ, and agree to commit something of what God has given us as citizens of this land, and to use the gift of our citizenship on behalf of hungry people, to be a collective voice in helping to shape national policies that could make a difference for people who suffer from lack of essential food. And so we began organizing by state and by congressional district. And over the years, we've developed now membership of some 42,000 people, and we have, I guess, in most congressional district, local groups and district and state coordinators and various kinds of activities. But basically, the basic activity is members who simply, on key targeted issues that we select, are willing to sit down and write a letter to a U.S. representative or to their U.S. senators and say, you know, please support, you know, bill number, whatever, because we think it's important for these reasons. And members who will sometimes sit down and meet with their members of Congress or be in contact with their offices in other ways. I can tell you that we haven't always gotten what we've been after. There have been plenty of times when we've bumped our noses or stubbed our toes, been disappointed. But often enough, we have made a tangible difference. We've been able to see how the efforts of a relatively handful of people in each congressional district has made the difference, has been able, you know, has been able to gather the kind of support for an issue and push it on through when we're quite sure that without that effort, nothing would have happened. Just to throw out a few examples of the kinds of things that we've Bread for the World has been responsible for, or primarily responsible for. We drafted the legislation for the farmer-held grain reserve that was put in place back in 1978 as a part of the 1978 Farm Bill. And that is a reserve that has helped to stabilize the price and supply of grain both here in this country and worldwide. Along with it, a later companion government-held emergency grain reserve stands as a kind of an insurance policy for against famine in developing countries to assure that the price of grain, when the supply is thin and the price goes way up, that and famines occur, that U.S. food aid will still be able to be sent abroad. We've been active in various types of food aid reform measures last year primarily, and currently this year as well, on what we call targeted aid reforms, measures to help target more U.S. development aid to people who fall within the World Bank's category of being absolutely poor, the poorest of the poor. And aid reforms that push in the direction of aid for self-reliance, that enable the very poor to really become more self-productive and get on their feet, work their own way out of hunger and poverty. We've worked hard on domestic hunger issues too. Currently, our major initiative this year has been a resolution that we drafted and was introduced in both houses of Congress called the Preventing Hunger at Home resolution, and basically saying, you know, no more cutbacks on food programs aimed at the very poor. And it served as a rallying point in Congress and among the public for preventing further cutbacks, and it looks now as though we may even be able to get some of those previous cuts restored for several of the domestic food programs. So that's the kind of issue that Bread for the World has been into. And I'd just add one other point, because it's so very basic to us. We do root our movement in explicitly in Christian faith. And to me, to us at Bread for the World, that is a very important thing. That we do what we do, not somehow as kind of on the margin of faith, but as a part and parcel of the life that we celebrate in Christ. It seems to me that it's important also because it's very easy to hear about world hunger and move because we've been made to feel guilty. And while guilt has a place, I mean, maybe that's something we need to feel a bit to start with, in the long run, I think guilt immobilizes people. And basically, we do what we do in Bread for the World, not because we have a, you know, some kind of an onerous burden laid on us, but because God has called us to celebrate life more fully. And it is our joy, really, our privilege, to be able to stand with brothers and sisters who are hungry and to let our lives, in some small way, at least, count for them. I mean, that is really part of the call to the kingdom. And when we respond to that call and when we celebrate the kingdom more fully, that is really a matter of great joy to us then. It's not something that should produce long faces, but should help us hold our heads high and fulfill our own lives more completely as well. So I've rambled on too long. Let's open it up here. And
question to expand on this a little further. Three-part question. How many other similar hunger organizations are there in the country? Compared to all of them, how are you similar? And also, what makes the organization you participate in unique?
Okay. First of all, and I'm not sure if this is part of your intent in the question or not, Bread for the World does not do any direct assistance. We're strictly a citizens' lobby, public policy group. So if compared to Lutheran World Relief, Church World Service, Catholic Relief Services, World Vision, you know, a whole range of direct assistance groups, we don't compete with them at all. We focus exclusively on efforts to change and have an impact on national policy, policies that are determined by the Congress and by the administration. So in that sense, we complement well what those groups are doing, but we don't do the same things. And as a result, we are very supportive of them and their work, and they in turn have been very supportive of our efforts too.
So your main effort is the lobbying to Congress to spring free further monies?
Well, lobbying of Congress to get policies enacted that we think will more effectively address the problem of hunger. That sometimes means springing loose more money, but not necessarily, not always. There are often initiatives that are not money initiatives. The targeted aid measures, for example, we're not asking for more money, but asking for a redirection of the aid that we are already committed to so that more of it reaches directly the very poor.
Now, you mentioned a $12 million figure earlier. What was that for?
Just a rough ballpark guess of how much Lutherans in this country contribute through their churches toward direct hunger relief.
Okay, that was not specifically to
pray. No. That was by way of contrast or comparison. I mean, here, you know, it takes 9 million of us to raise a few bucks that do a lot of good, as a matter of fact, and should be 10 times that, 20 times that. But we can also make a difference by using not the gift of our money, but the gift of our time and effort in helping to change public policies.
A couple questions. When we were in Germany, I noticed Bret Fierdeville or something.
Right, Bro Fierdeville.
Is the organization international?
No, it is not. Bro Fierdeville in Germany, Bread for the World, is like Church World Service or Lutheran World Relief. It is really the big private relief and development agency based in Germany, and they do work in developing countries throughout the world. But we, again, you know, we are not that kind of organization. We're strictly a U.S.-based organization working on public policy.
Then the other thing is, it seems like every time I get a a newsletter from Bread for the World and see some targeted thing that I'm to write to my congressman about. I just have the feeling that my congressman says, oh, here's Mary Schramm again, writing the whole village about the same old thing. And I just wonder how effective my letters are after writing.
Yeah.
And I seem to be saying the same thing and encouraging them to do this or that in regard to world hunger. And I just sometimes think it just doesn't do any good anymore.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, I can't tell in any specific case, and situations differ so much. I mean, it may depend on your member of Congress, for one thing. It may depend on how often you write. You know, if you write him every day, he probably begins to say, oh, there's Mary Schramm again, you know. We know what she's going to write about. On balance, our impression is that not very often people overdo it. You know, if you write a sensible letter about a specific issue and you have a fair point to make, you can be reasonably confident that somebody in that office is going to pay attention to it. You know, there are members of Congress who are just so bad, or maybe so good, you know, that it's not going to make a lot of difference. But we've seen many times when, even with members of Congress who appear to be just dead losers, you know, have been swung around on at least some issues. In other cases where you think they're so good, they always vote right, but those letters of support can make, you know, so they vote right, but they don't do much behind the scenes. If they know they've got support and really a lot of interest back in the district or state, maybe they'll go to bat for a thing and be more aggressive on it than they would, and that can make a difference. So those letters really do help.
How do you select which bills to support, which ones not to support?
Yeah, that's a long, tangled process, and there, you know, so many possibilities. And how do you pick the ones that you think are going to? We work at that at various levels. One is, of course, we have a staff of issue analysts who are, you know, working in various areas and constantly looking for appropriate targets and positions to take regarding targets. Some of these we initiate. I mean, some of these we develop ourselves. For example, the targeted aid legislation that I mentioned, or the Preventing Hunger at Home resolution, or the Grain Reserve bill. These were things that we drafted and got initiated. Doesn't mean that we're the only ones who were interested in it, but we took the initiative and wrote up the legislation, and then we negotiate that with the congressional persons who are going to be introducing it. I mean, we never can just hand them something and say introduce it. We give them something we think makes sense, and then we work with them to shape something that we can all live with. Other things we pick up because they're not our initiative, they're just coming down the pike, they're on the congressional agenda, and we think they're important enough to target. But we do have to limit our targets. One way of becoming ineffective is trying to tackle everything. So we do, you know, we do limit ourselves to, at any given point, a small number, usually something like, you know, 4 to 6 things that we may be working on. And they may be at different stages in Congress. Some are in committees or subcommittees, and others may be coming to the floor for a vote. So we do the staff work. We also try to listen very carefully to our membership. We're always getting letters in from the members. Local groups are having meetings passing on their opinions. We have people who go out in the field, organizers who are out in the field regularly. And we have seminars and conferences, and those are ways we get feedback. We try to take that into account too, having some sense of where the membership is on issues. We have a board then too, to which the staff is responsible and are accountable. And the board meets 3 times a year, and the board will we'll approve our basic positions and selections of issues.
Has the group taken any position on the possibility of making grain that is currently buried or not being grown by law that could be made available to poor people?
Yes, in several ways. We'd like to see some of that made, some more of it made available for domestic use, for one thing. More important to us now is that while we've got the kind of, well, of course, with the PIC program coming up, that's a question, but, you know, while we're in a surplus situation, that's a time to build a base for a bigger, more effective grain reserve program internationally. We've made some very important steps over the last years here in the States setting up the two grain reserves. They probably need to be expanded. They also need to be coordinated with what should become an international system of national reserves. And that's never really gotten off the ground. This would be an opportunity. That's the kind of thing we would like to see pushed. It does not make a lot of sense simply when we've got surplus to simply start pouring huge amounts of grain abroad as food aid. You have to use food aid very, very carefully, or it can do more damage than good. It can undercut local farmers. It can serve as a disincentive to increasing food production in the developing countries. So food aid has to be used very, very carefully, and I just throw that out as a caution, because that tends to be our first impulse. I mean, we've got a lot, people are hungry, let's send it over.
Is that why the government has the farmer cut down 20% of his corn crop and everything? They don't even grow it at all?
Well, I think the reason for that is basically because of the oversupply here in the States and the bind that's put the U.S. farmer in. I mean, it's more a concern about, you know, the U.S. farmer than it is. I don't think it has very much to do at all with a concern for the situation abroad.
Well, but does the group oppose this philosophy? What I think I hear you saying is that in order to protect the farmer, our group is condoning the either destroying of food product and making it unavailable to the poor.
No, well, we're
to protect the farmer.
That isn't, the answer is a little more complicated than a simple yes or no. Basically, we've got some real reservations about what is in effect a combination of set aside of acreage with payment in kind, you know, paying back to the farmer in grain some of the land that's set aside not put into production. The problem we see is that, you know, it is an opportunity when we're in a surplus situation to do some things, some positive things that could make use of that grain to provide for more world food security. And we may very well be moving into a situation where, you know, that surplus is going to be drawn down so rapidly, and then if we hit some lean years, either here in the States or abroad, where we could be in a serious food deficit. And a lot of people could really perish as a result. So, first of all, we're very worried of that. I think having said that, though, one has to acknowledge there may be a necessity, though it has to be handled very carefully, of reserving some land from production simply to provide for a more stable supply and price of grain. Now, I don't know enough about it to know, you know, where you draw that line. And I'm very concerned that it be done with enormous care so that you don't invite problems later on that should never occur. But I think we're stepping into a risky situation with the PIC program.
I learned recently that the chief cattle raising area of southern Angola had been overrun by South Africans, and so cattle production had come to a stop, and now they had moved into the maize-producing part of the country, and the result was a lot of new hunger in Angola that the United States was U.S. food aid would not relate to at all, because the United States government doesn't recognize the Angolan government.
Yeah.
And I'll bet that Joel can cite similar situations in Latin America. So now my question is Bread for the World able to relate to that kind of politicization of foreign aid, or do you find, for reasons of effectiveness, that you kind of have to work where there is not too much hostile ideological feeling? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Do you find that it's more effective for you to work with countries that we are friendly with and try and improve that relationship, or are you able to address the situation like Angola?
Well, we can address those particular situations on occasion, though, you know, you can only handle so much. Currently, the situation that we've been working on is Ethiopia, where real famine has developed, and from all reports from private voluntary agencies, that situation is becoming very critical. And so we, for the last couple of months, have been working primarily behind the scenes, but a lot of our members have been writing to their members of Congress, too, to get after the State Department and USAID to respond to that. We, just last week, AID did announce that they were sending 3 million tons of food, or combination food and some transportation help through CRS to Ethiopia, much too limited a response in view of the need. And the major need right now is for transportation, not for the grain. And we've been very reluctant to supply any transportation. Now, the basic reason why we didn't move in much more quickly and haven't moved more vigorously is simply that Ethiopia has not been viewed as a friendly country. You know, it's another example of where our geopolitical concerns have taken precedence. And that is, tends to be a prevailing problem.
All right, let me ask Chuck's question with a bit of a twist to it. His question about how you select issues or to work on. But this time not so much focused on process as such, but to ask whether Bread for the World has a kind of set of criteria that are used for selecting the issues. I mean, for example, you want to do that which gets food to the poorest of the poor, maybe that addresses systemic issues and not only to try to facilitate more money for relief efforts, etc. Are there such factors at work in selecting issue areas?
Yeah, there are two things that can refer to in that regard. One is just a statement of policy, which is in the back of my book. It's a working statement of policy, and it needs to be updated. Now there are a few things that are a bit out of date there, but basically that provides a framework and still holds pretty well for the issues that we move on. Beyond that, we do have a set of criteria that helps us in the selection of issues, and they do include the kinds of things that you've mentioned. They also include such things as winnability. Does it have a prospect for really getting what you go after? I mean, there's usually, not necessarily, but usually there's not much point in going after something if you know you're going to lose it. Now, that may not always be the case. There may be times when something is so important, or maybe only a foot in the door for something you see happening positively a few years down the road, so you want to go after it even if you know you're going to lose it. But nevertheless, calculating the political reality is a part of what you have to take into account. So there are some criteria along those lines that we use.
along that line, I don't seem to find that Bread for the World is pushing heavily toward military spending, against military spending. Do you just feel that that's a battle that can't be won, so there's not that much emphasis, or you don't have a handle to grab hold of in regard to it, or do I just not read the information?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we are very much concerned about that issue, and we've done some things, mostly pretty low-key. We've pushed fairly hard behind the scenes for getting an independent analysis of the defense budget, but not successfully. I mean, that's been one of the things that we failed. We're each year, as some of you know, we have what we call an offering of letters in the churches. Really is kind of a gimmick, in a way, a method of getting lots, not only our members, but lots of people in congregations across the country to get people initially involved in writing to members of Congress on the hunger issue. So we'll select some issue or some area for people to write about, and that usually carries, if not our major, one of our major issues for the year. Well, the one that we've got coming up that will be announced in September is aid-related legislation that will, number one, ask that approximately $250 million more be put into humanitarian development aid that we feel will be going to, in an effective way, to the people who need it the most, through such means as increasing contributions to UNICEF, the U.S. health account in our through the Agency for International Development, through the International Fund for Agricultural Development, and some means such as those. So, on the one hand, increasing our humanitarian development aid, and secondly, calling for a moratorium on increases in military aid. Our military assistance has really skyrocketed over the last several years, and we really wanted to go after a cutback on military aid. Our reading in Congress was that that would have been probably self-defeating. It would not have been taken seriously. So we're going after a moratorium, which is a somewhat modest effort, but if we can get even that, we'll have made a great gain. Now, that applies to military assistance going to developing countries and some not-so-developing countries. Does not apply to the overall U.S. defense budget and defense spending, which is another issue and a much bigger issue than the one that this particular target will address.
I've always been sort of curious and interested about exactly how lobbying works, and I've always had the opinion that the only successful lobbyists were the ones that had a lot of money in their pocket. And you refer to we, and I just wonder if you could expand a little bit.
Yeah, you've either got to have money or a lot of bodies out there to will speak up, and we go for the latter because we don't have much money. Our lobbyists basically are the people. I mean, we call ourselves a citizens' lobby. And it's by getting folks in a given congressional district to be in touch with a member of Congress who knows that he's hearing or she's hearing from the folks back home. You know, that's what can make a difference. We could go as Bread for the World and testify before congressional committees and develop the finest conceivable positions and get virtually no attention at all because people would shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's fine, but, doesn't represent any of my voters. We've had some clout in Congress only because we've had members back in the states and districts who speak up and express themselves. So, you're right in a way. You know, lobbying usually takes a lot of money. But if you don't have money, you've got to have people who will speak up, and that's really the way Bread for the World works.
Just something to affirm a couple of the statements you made. We, within the last year, just started writing letters. Something we've just come into doing. Sort of on our own local level, we've even written to our own commissioners, and it was our experience that writing letters to them and then also to the newspapers, within the first two or four letters we wrote, all of a sudden we were getting offers from commissioners to come into their office and discuss some of these things with them, which you know, I never would have dreamed that that would have happened. And there were only maybe three or four letters at the most written. And suddenly they are very aware of who we are in our community. Also, on the national level, or we've written to our congressman, and unlike Mary, I guess we've gotten response to every letter we've ever written to anyone. We've gotten a response from them. We haven't always been very pleasant or in agreement with things that we've said, but we've always known that they've gotten those letters. Mm-hmm. So I feel that that's an affirmation of those actions. And also, by way of a question, then, I'm wondering, you've been saying much about dealing with the money involved with all this. I wonder, do you get involved at all otherwise in the justice issues or the poverty issues? I know you're saying going in the back door and trying to give money to UNICEF and to all the other things to make sure that the money goes to the right places within through legislation and things. Do you get involved in
Again, our effectiveness depends on keeping focus. You know, you can only work on a limited number of things, and even when you talk about things that are very directly related to hunger, you've got a whole range of possibilities to pick from, and you've got to limit yourself even on those. So we do not get into, you know, there are a lot of justice issues that I'm personally very much interested in, and immigration certainly is an important one. But we'd be spreading ourselves too thin, and I think lose some of our credibility if we started branching out. So we have not gotten into other issues. I think a lot of our members, you know, we have gotten a lot of people involved in the hunger issue, and many of them have from there branched out and also gotten involved in others, and we're very happy about that. But our agenda is always fairly focused. I appreciate also what you said about your response to the letters, because that's certainly been, you know, our experience overall. You mentioned writing letters to the editor, and that can be very effective. If you write a letter to the editor on a hunger issue, it's especially helpful if in that connection you mention your U.S. representative or, you know, one of your senators, because you know that they are clipping those things and it's bound to get to the attention of your member of Congress. And you can mention him in a good sense. I mean, not, you know, you can say, you know, we certainly hope that Representative so-and-so will take this into account when he considers. My brother Paul is a member of Congress from Southern Illinois, contends that, you know, a letter sent to a member of Congress on a hunger issue saves a life. Now, he doesn't mean that literally every letter you can trace to, you know, some individual's life has been saved, but on balance, on average, you know, it has that kind of impact. Yeah, don't send a mimeograph letter. I mean, if it's obviously a form letter, you know, that it should be and ordinarily will get little attention, and might even be detrimental. Between hand and typewritten letter, I don't know that it makes that much difference. I think what matters more is that it's it's the kind of letter that it is. If it has a good point to make, makes it clearly and, you know, fairly briefly, and is put in a courteous way, it'll probably be effective.
techniques now, isn't it? They're usually true that a single point letter is most effective.
Right. You don't want to, if you write a letter and say, you know, here are six things I'd like you to consider, probably they may select one out of the bunch and put it in that pile, but you're better off, I think, right? If you've got, you know, if you've got 2 points you want to make, you're better off writing 2 separate letters. Mm-hmm. And each one gets considered, Well, that probably happens. I think in general, that's okay. You know, if you know the gist of the idea you want to get across and people are putting it in their own words, sure, you get some phrases or words that are, you know, begin to get repeated in various letters. And I suppose if in congressional offices, they can begin to pick some of that up. And they often know then that Bread for the World is active on an issue and we're getting our members to write in on it, and that's okay. I don't think you need to worry too much about that, but it is good not to just lift off a lot of phrases and just, you know, regurgitate them word for word. You want to avoid that. The more you can put it in your own words, the better.
What is this agricultural thing you said you were talking about that was coming up in September that you were trying to get at? What was the agricultural aspect of the $250 million part of the
goal? Well, we're going to announce in September that our next effort, which will really be aimed at next year's session of Congress. But we'll announce it in September. People will get going with it around November, Thanksgiving time, and then on into next year. But one of the things that we'd like to see more adequately funded is IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development.
And that's for other countries.
That's right. Yeah, that's for developing countries. They have a very good track record of encouraging ag development among subsistence farmers, very, very poor farmers, small scale farmers in developing countries. They really do reach a lot of the very poor that often other ag development efforts don't reach. So,
I guess one of the problems that I really have, and especially with hunger, is why, if there's so much hunger in the world, why are we as Americans ourselves and Congress itself making the laws saying, let's don't grow this food on this land? When we have all this land available, the farmers are being paid not to grow anything on it, mm-hmm. and yet people are starving in other countries. And yet we justify it by saying, no, it's going to raise food prices or farmers' prices and stuff, and we tell ourselves that. You know, I know there's a lot of times I justify things that I do,
sure.
and it's wrong. The Lord only gave me today.
Yeah.
He hasn't given me tomorrow yet. How do I know there's going to be a famine tomorrow? But I do trust the Lord that He's going to take care of me no matter what happens. Where do we deviate from that and say, hey, we don't believe in that? And we as a church or a body that's saying that we don't still believe that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I agonize with you on this one.
I got to go with you on the right bandwagon.
Yeah. I guess my basic point here would be the solution to the problem of hunger in developing countries is not for the United States to send its surpluses abroad. You know, what that will do will be to undermine farmers in those developing countries. And basically the solution has to be that those farmers become more food productive. You know, we've got to think in terms of self-reliant development, you know, within each developing country. And, you know, conceivably through the best of intentions, we could, although we've done this not always with the best of intentions, we can send our surplus abroad. That solves a problem for us. But it may cause problems and has caused problems in those countries. And when prices are depressed there, sure, there's some short-term advantage maybe to the particularly urban populations, but it simply takes the rug out from the farmers of those countries. and...
Well, then why did the Bread for the World support the coffee boycott? I mean, why? Is that what you mean by, should we not drink coffee and tea and bananas and buy Dole fruit and stuff so that the land there is used to feed the people in those lands? I mean, where do we start being practical and having something to grab hold of for what you're saying?
Okay, I think you're shifting into a slightly different issue here, I think, which is okay, but we haven't gotten into boycotts as we've reported these generally, like particularly the infant formula thing. We were, a lot of our people got into the infant formula issue, so we never made that one of our targets because it was not basically a piece of legislation. It was not primarily a matter of public policy. I was going to make another point here and I've lost it.
Well, I didn't mean boycott maybe so much as just, do we as Americans, in order to give those farmers a chance, they have to have land where they can produce food
right.
instead of export items for us?
Sure, okay. All right, well, as an example of the kind of thing that we work on there, last year in the administration proposed what it called its Caribbean Basin Initiative. Caribbean Basin, interpreted in a very broad sense to include Central America. Now that's a very mixed bag, and we have very mixed feelings about it, but we did last year put in an amendment to the CBI legislation, which we call the Land for Food Amendment. We were worried that incentives that the CBI offered to those, to companies going into those countries would have the effect of turning more productive land away from the production of staple food crops for local consumption and to the production of primarily sugar and beef or livestock for export sale. And so this was an amendment which provided some safeguards against that happening. Well, the CBI legislation didn't go anywhere in the last session, although we did get that amendment passed by the House against, spite of administration opposition. This year, when the administration put in a CBI legislation, they agreed to include the land for food provision in that legislation. It looks now like the CBI is going to go through and it will go through with that provision in it. Well, it's a very small thing overall. I mean, that's a tiny thing, but it's a specific thing and it could, could make a very real difference for people in that part of the world. It provides safeguards not only, for seeing food be changed from local food production to export sale production, but also provide some safeguards against the accumulation of larger land holdings by, by companies or by well-to-do farmers. So that, again, as I say, that's a very small example, but you almost have to deal with fairly narrow and specific features in order to, in order to get something, get some action on something.
Do you think that some hope that the future rests in advocating for small-scale farmers in developing countries as opposed to larger-scale farmers?
Oh yeah, I mean we think that's very fundamental. Certainly the way development has to occur in developing countries if we're going to really talk about enabling the poorest of the poor and the hungry among the poor to work their way up. It's got to be by providing opportunities for the really really impoverished farmers and farm workers in those
What about in some situations where the national policy has been to firm development of large-scale cooperatives?
Yeah, again, well, it depends on what you mean by cooperatives. Cooperatives can be a good way to go. You know, if it, you know, I think the basic question is who benefits. You know, if it really does benefit and include the truly poor, you know, fine. I think cooperatives are a good thing. So much does depend on the policy of the developing country. I mean, and we'd be kidding ourselves if we felt, well, the U.S. Congress or the U.S. administration can call the shots for what happens in those countries. We can do very little. Now, what the little we can do is nevertheless very important. You know, we can provide examples. We can, in small ways, provide incentives that, you know, will encourage policy development in one way or another in those countries. But ultimately and basically, it's going to depend on the policies of those countries. And are those policies going to, policies that are directed toward including and benefiting the very poor, are they policies that bypass the poor, basically benefit the well-to-do? I mean, that is a fundamental question.
Who actually has charge of this surplus that we have? Is there a specific group that has charge? The president, is that correct, who has charge of all the surplus that we have?
Well, surpluses are basically held by farmers.
Paid to hold.
And farmers are paid to hold the surpluses. There's also, you know, some of the surplus is bought by the government, held in the Commodity Credit through the Commodity Credit Corporation. But basically, it's a private market situation in which the government cooperates.
One of the things I've seen, I guess it was about 3 months ago, as a matter of fact, I was on my honeymoon, and I seen a movie from Africa where these people were overcome, and the gorillas and everything pushed 100,000 people out, and they were living in a desert. Nothing there but a little stream, and they urine, everybody had dysentery, all the kids were nothing but bones,
yeah.
And there was a couple, three missionaries, and they're pleading and begging for money. Isn't that a place where we can make an exception and say, hey, there's food, there's a need. There is a need, and it's not just given to some country that needs farming or that we have the capability of doing something like that. Here's people that are starving, and they don't have a choice.
Right, no, absolutely. I think there are two...
How do we go about helping them?
Yeah, there are two conditions under which food aid makes sense. I mean, I think there is a real place for food aid. One is emergency situations, like the one you described. You know, Cambodia was a good example of that, too. Ethiopia is now. There are emergencies, and there's only one thing to do, and that is get food there as fast as you can. Secondly, food aid is good if it's used in a developmental fashion. That is, if it's used in a way that doesn't pull the rug out from under the local farmers, but is related to efforts by the government to move agricultural development favorably towards subsistence farmers and enable them to, say as an example, that food for work projects where farmers or villagers may be paid in food to, say, to build roads or to build reservoirs, irrigation systems, that have, you know, so you get a double benefit. They get more food, but they're also investing then in what will enable them to become more food productive themselves over the long haul. Yeah. Thank you. I'd like to thank Mary Schramm and all the other folks who do what they do for Bread for the World.
For all our letters, yeah.
Yeah, for all your letters. Keep it up.